So Tim and I will both offer a little bit tonight to get us started on this exploration of the twin pathways of wisdom and love. I don't know how many of you read the retreat descriptions, but the area of exploration for tonight and the weekend are how the pathways of love might intersect. And part of one of the fun things about team teaching, other than getting to spend time together, is we each get to offer kind of our piece around that. So you get to hear from kind of two slightly different perspectives, hopefully complementary. But as we were thinking about what to offer about the wisdom and love elements of practice, we thought it would be very easy to slide into a kind of good cop, bad cop paradigm, right? Tim takes wisdom and I take love, or I take love and Tim takes wisdom. So we won't do that, all right? Yeah, we'll each just offer a little bit of our own reflections around that, and hopefully they'll be woven together more than they will be kind of parallel paths. So I remember asking my teacher, can't even remember the context now, but some question about what brings people to practice initially. So after he had seen, thousands of people in the beginning, middle, and later stages of practice, what brings people to practice initially? And his opinion was that it was one of two things. It was either a deep curiosity, a very deep wanting to know, wanting to understand. What is this? Human life, what is this? And the other one was deep heartbreak, right? Like a breaking heart. And suffering that was becoming harder and harder to relate to. So I remember that really striking me. Deep curiosity or deep heartbreak. And then later we had a conversation about why do people continue? All these people, a lot of people fall away after a short period of time, but what allows people to continue after they've been practicing for a while? And I remember his answer being somewhat similar. Deepening curiosity and deepening heartbreak. Right? So we can feel both of these very deep human impulses of the human heart. The longing to understand our experience, to really know it with some clarity, with some depth, and also to somehow come out of this experience of suffering, this caring to the point of it sinking us, toppling us, the breaking heart. So I know for myself, early in practice, it was actually a bit hard to connect with curiosity. I would hear teachers say again and again, just be curious about your experience, just be curious. And all I could feel was torment and kind of being toppled around and not really knowing which way was up. So it was very hard to connect with curiosity. But I could very much connect with this sense of heartbreak. And how can I be with this? How can I relate to this? So I mentioned this to start because I think it's helpful as we begin to reflect on maybe what some of our own impulses are, but to deepest intentions, but to also see how qualities like curiosity and this deep caring, the heart that's breaking for ourselves, for the world, how with awareness, they can develop us on the path. They can support each other, but they can also deepen into wisdom and into love, right? So I'll talk a little bit more about those terms and what they mean and kind of operational definitions, how we're using them. But I find, especially in these times, a lot of people are asking similar questions about, like, what's essential, right? What's essential in life and in practice? What's at the core of this? So often when people are starting, especially, they're kind of entering what, you know, we have the advantage of being kind of so many Dharma resources at this point, right? So many different traditions, different teachers, books, podcasts, apps, magazines, articles, mindfulness research. Really, it's this spiritual marketplace. And people are asking, like, what's the essence of this? How do I navigate from this plethora of options? What's most essential? So what we'd like to focus on this weekend is really what's at the heart of these practices, of this path. And so these two elements of wisdom and compassion. So the Buddha had a wonderful image that I come back to again and again. And in a dialogue with, it was a monk and another practitioner who was trying to understand something of the Buddha's that hadn't made sense in the first go, a talk of his that hadn't made sense. And so he was trying to understand this, and he was saying, explain it to me. And the monk was trying to give him some direction, and he said, it's as though everyone is searching for the heartwood of a tree, the essence of a tree. What is the innermost essence of a tree? And yet they're spending all of this time playing with the branches and the leaves, trying to find the essence in kind of the periphery of the branches and the leaves. You're not going to find the heartwood essence, that which is the core of the tree that gives sustenance, that gives support and stability. The branches and leaves are part of the tree, but they're not the heartwood. They're not the essence. This always struck me as a really powerful image. So we may each of us answer this differently. Like, what is for us? What is the heartwood, or what is the essence of practice? And I think what we'll explore tonight and this weekend is these qualities of wisdom and love, as being like part of that heartwood, part of the core or the root, also what develops, what strengthens in practice. So Joseph Goldstein, another senior Western teacher in this tradition, Tim and I have both studied with a bit, spoke about it in this way, in terms of this essence or core. And he said, in this kind of emerging Western Buddhism, right? So Buddhism, as it's growing and developing, maturing in the West, drawing from these different traditions, these different streams and strands, he said, his perspective was that in all of this, the essence of the practice is wisdom, right? The method is mindfulness, and the expression is compassion, right? So it can be helpful to think of these three kind of angles on what we're doing here and how we approach practice. So there's a method, what we do when we practice. We bring awareness to each moment of experience. That's our primary doing, if you can call it a doing. So in this moment, bringing awareness to experience, we can know sounds being heard. We can know that there is a body. We can know that the body's sitting. We can know that there's fatigue, there's interest, curiosity, there's care, there's agitation. It's awareness, meeting, experience. So we can call that a method. And that can be developed, it can be strengthened, it can be more continuous. But the essence of why we practice that mindfulness, why we bring awareness to the fore over and over again, is the development of wisdom, of understanding. It's not just a blank stare into experience, right? It's not just a stare down. It's because in doing that, we actually are able to discern, to start to understand what this is, what it's about. And the expression of that understanding is compassion, or is a deepening sense of relationship, connection, and response to the world. So this has been all of these have been very helpful frameworks. So this sense of a heartwood coming back to essence. And I know, you know, in these times, the barrage of things coming at us, not just at us, but around us, through us on a daily basis. You know, in one day, we have elections, we have shootings, right? We have political fluctuations, we have news of worsening climate change. And we have our own personal kind of dramas and catastrophes and difficulties. And so continuing to use this method, this awareness, but remembering or circling around really what's essential, coming back to what's essential over and over again. It's vital for our practice. So I know for myself in the beginning, I was quite enamored with clarity. Being, like I mentioned, in a place of a lot of, felt like turmoil and personal suffering, when I could actually experience the capacity of the mind stabilizing and settling just a little bit, so there was some clarity, so I knew what I was seeing. This was very, very compelling for me. It's like the image came to me today. If you ever hand a young child a phone and ask them to take a video, it's like you get a dizzying experience of the ceiling, the floor, the window. It's a tumult, right? So this is how it can feel when we're completely merged with experience. It's like we're in a clothes dryer. We're just being tossed around by experience. And so as that started to settle just a little bit, and I could actually discern what was happening. Okay. Oh, that's a chair. That's a ceiling. That's a wall. That's fear. That's anticipation. That's joy. That clarity, being able to see the truth of what I was experiencing in a moment-to-moment basis, was very compelling. So without really knowing it, began to sort of fixate around this clarity. This is what the practice is about. It's about this kind of laser beam focus and kind of illuminating of experience. And in some ways, that's true. But anytime anyone mentioned cultivating qualities of heart, like loving kindness or compassion, my thought was, what's the point? I could not connect with any impulse. It felt to me like so relieving to leave life alone and just experience it as it was, that to try to what felt like manipulate it in any way, to try to concoct or cultivate wisdom felt artificial. To cultivate compassion felt artificial. Let me just see it as it is. So there was wisdom arising, being able to see kind of the nature of experience, to see it come, to actually see it pass, to see a mood fade away and disintegrate and realize that isn't who I am. But there wasn't so much a connection to this human relational world. So I remember going to my teacher and saying, I feel calm. I feel settled a lot more of the time. I feel this great relief in that settledness. But I'm not necessarily feeling connected to humanity, right? There's a bit of a distance. And so he said, keep practicing, keep going, keep practicing, right? So this is one development, one side of the practice. And later on in my practice, in that kind of phase, I was told in more traditional format that Vipassana, or the development of wisdom through insight, was this like deep surgical operation, the serious stuff that extracts greed, hatred, and delusion. This is the serious work. And metta, or loving kindness, is just kind of the balm that you smear on afterwards to make it all feel better, right? Doesn't necessarily heal or solve anything, but it just kind of gets you through the grittiness of it, right? So when a British monk in the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Amaro, said, sometimes metta is treated as this like after dinner mint, you know, that just is brought out to freshen the room up a little bit, right? So we can have these preferences, and we can, I think it's very natural to start out with one of these being more compelling than the other. But at some point, these three all come together. Like in my experience, mindfulness, love, and wisdom seem to more and more intersect, interweave, and be inseparable. It's helpful to see them as distinct, but it's also helpful to see how they're mutually necessary and interweaving. So I began to see in my own practice that if I'm going to live in the world, if I am going to be able to be effective, integrated, able to relate, able to respond, that not only does the mind have to open, but the heart also has to open as well, right? So again, these aren't ultimately separate. We tend to think of them as separate, but in the Buddhist understanding, these are together. So the citta, called the heart mind, and its function is to know, right? To know, but it's also to care, to be affected, right? So it's exquisitely sensitive. It's the affective response. So it has these two functions of knowing and caring. So we can think about wisdom, just teasing it apart for a second. Wisdom as the capacity to discern, right? As to make, for a time, a separation, right? To know, this is helpful, this is unhelpful. This leads towards awakening, this leads away from awakening. Those are very helpful distinctions, right? This is frustration. This is restlessness. To see those as somewhat distinct. So wisdom has this discerning quality to it. It's able to make distinctions, able to sense difference in a way. It's not the end of the story. It doesn't stop there. If we get enamored by that capacity of wisdom to know and discern, it's very easy to get fixated around our judgments. It's very difficult to stop with just the discernment and not get fixated around judgment, right? To stop at this is this, and not say this is better, this is worse. This is helpful, this is unhelpful. Not this is good, this is bad, this is better, this is worse. So this is where love can come in. So talking about love, and we'll explain this a little more this weekend. So not to think of it so much, Tim, as we were talking about this in preparation for this weekend, said, I had kind of an allergy to the word love. So this isn't, we're not talking about love kind of in the Hallmark sense, syrupy, cotton candy sense of liking everything, of insisting that everything's sweet and that there is no difficulty, there is no pain or challenge. But more and more I'm thinking of love as basic openness, right? Of basic openness of heart that's there when we're not clinging, right? This basic capacity of the mind to care, to include, to respond, to move towards. So if wisdom can discern, then love can include, right? And they can seem like opposites, but they're always working in tandem, helpful, helping one another. So if the shadow side of getting tippy with wisdom, tipping over into really preferencing that wisdom, we can really solidify around a view, right? Even a view of practice. This is practice. This is spiritual. And if we get tippy on the other side, then that capacity to care gets limited or fixed around too small of an object or a person, right? My family, my community, my political party, my group. So it can stay kind of huddled around something that's a bit too small. If we keep coming back to this essential capacity of heart, we can allow these movements to continue to deepen and grow and not get fixated around something that's too small, too limited. So a lot more to say about both of those. I'll let Tim offer a little bit, and then we'll have some time for questions and dialogue tonight. Okay.
So love and wisdom. As Carrie was saying, when I was younger, I had a lot of trouble saying the word love, like I love you. It felt like it was some kind of everlasting vow, I would say, and I would be it was hard to actually say it, but I've kind of come, you know, to I say that quite a bit now. But I probably will tend to go between love and compassion very fluidly. So just to be aware of that. You know, listening to Carrie, you know, to give that beautiful talk, I was thinking about my own early practice time and how I came to practice really in the middle of a breakup of a short marriage and feeling the world shake under my feet. So when I heard the Dharma, there was a sense of, oh, maybe this can help me get over that pain. So there's a sense of the heartbreak that kind of brought me in, but there was the wisdom that was kind of a way of, oh, maybe if I'm wise enough, I won't hurt as much. And so that was maybe the initial part of that hook. And as many of you who've practiced a while, you start to realize that wisdom and compassion aren't two things. They're actually one and the same. And that for our practice to really deepen and mature, they have to see them as one and the same. And as Carrie mentioned, we may have a bias toward one or the other, just a natural bias or inclination. Sometimes it's the circumstances of our life that we come into practice just awash with the immense suffering, the immense grief of the situation, the conditions of our lives, of our bodies, of the people around us. You know, so we each have this perhaps bias. But ultimately, we do have to see that wisdom and compassion, wisdom and love are one and the same. In fact, they really need each other. Right? 'Cause sometimes we take wisdom as the intellectual wisdom, the knowledge. You know, I can list off the Eightfold Path and the 12 steps of dependent origination and the 7 factors of enlightenment and the hindrances and all these different lists. I can recite suttas. I can feel like I'm wise because I have all this knowledge. Right? But this is really knowledge masquerading as wisdom. And what compassion does is it takes the abstract concept and shows its actual expression in this heart, in this body, in this life, in these relationships, in this way that you meet the world. Right? So it takes from this abstract in through the gateway of the personal. It takes the impersonal wisdom and through the personal, often suffering, and also joy. From that personal aspect, then it starts to become true wisdom. Same thing with compassion. When we feel overwhelmed by the suffering in ourselves and others and the ones we love, looking at the society and the world as a whole, we become washed away by that. Feel like we can't find a place to stand. And then wisdom comes in from this very personal overwhelm and start to show the impersonal nature of suffering, of joy, of love. And in that way, it starts to find its place of stability. So love and wisdom are so connected, so interrelated. So sense of wisdom, of compassion, I should say, is often talked about the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. That sense of really resonating with another's suffering, with your own suffering, really letting that in. And compassion also has this component of acting with wisdom with that, from that quivering, to make contact and from there to act. Now with this interplay between wisdom and compassion, we can look at almost, you can say, one of the bedrocks of wisdom in this larger Buddhist tradition is understanding these three essential characteristics of existence, of conditioned phenomenon, that each conditioned thing that arises. So conditioned meaning, you know, this life, this body, this mind state, the physicality of things. Everything is in a subject to being insubstantial. It's always in a process of arising and passing away. So there's a quality of dukkha, of insufficiency to it, insubstantiality, suffering of that. If you look closely, you can't find lasting happiness in conditioned experience. It's also a quality of impermanence, of anicca, that things are always arising and changing, always in flux. This is, these two are very related. And the final, the third characteristic is that of anatta, that there's not an essential self, essential lasting sense of me, of I, of mine, that does not change based on those conditions. Now you take those three characteristics, and there can be a sense of understanding them from an intellectual standpoint, from a wisdom standpoint. But the Dharma practice, sincere practice, really asks us to take it from the intellect into our direct experience. You know, this is good news because it means it becomes confirmed. It's not something you have to believe in, a faith-based practice. It's much more of a confirmed through your own experience. And the art of meditation is giving you the art of learning to see clearly and to understand what is being seen. In that seeing, life's lessons start to reveal themselves, both in the more subtle levels of the changing of the breath, the changing of sensations, the way the mind contracts around certain things and leans toward other things, to the much more gripping qualities when you have that diagnosis, when a loved one passes away, when a relationship ends, how to hold that with some sense of stability. Now looking at these three characteristics and the transformation from kind of an intellectual wisdom, a conceptual wisdom, into a embodied wisdom, dukkha, you know, the reality of insufficiency. So back when I first learned to practice, the first teaching I heard was a very simple one, that resistance times your experience equals suffering. Simple mathematical formula, right? So if you have an experience that's very light, small, you have a lot of resistance, the multiplier means you have more suffering. Same thing, a intense experience, very little resistance, not as much suffering, right? You have no resistance, you have no suffering. So, you know, going through that emotional pain, I thought, this sounds really interesting. Maybe I can learn not to have so much resistance to this and to this other experience and this experience. So it really kind of caught my eye, and I thought I understood it. I was being a good Dharma practitioner. Until a few years later, I was on a meditation retreat and I had a kidney stone attack. Right? So if you've ever had a kidney stone attack, you know it's pretty intense. I had a friend I was telling him about it, and he was telling a friend who was in the hospital with a kidney stone attack and had also been in Vietnam and been shot, and said the kidney stone was much worse. So, and I'm here, it's similar to childbirth for the mothers in the room. So, but in retreat, I thought, okay, I can hold this. I didn't know what it was at first. I thought it was a gas bubble, a really bad gas bubble. So I wasn't sitting like this. I was writhing in my room in the dark, but I was trying to feel the pain and open to it. And after 3 days of being a little stoic and stubborn toward it, I finally went to the ER, got some morphine, and felt much better. So I thought, okay, this is a nice, I learned how to meet this intensity. I got some empathy of pain, and okay. And then a few months later, that kidney stone I thought had dissolved, had actually would just stuck and started to move again. And the pain came back like that. And I could watch, the pain was there, but made much more worse was the added on fear of that past experience, of how intense that was, how much it cost to go to the ER and get the CAT scan. All this fear just multiplied that pain. I said, oh, that's what they mean by resistance times experience equals suffering. Taking an experience and I can make it much worse. This added on piece is really the avenue of Dharma practice, is learning not to multiply our suffering, not to multiply our experience with our suffering, with our resistance. So in this way, I started to take this intellectual understanding of dukkha and the origination of dukkha, this resistance toward experience, into my body, into my actual knowledge. So it went from intellectual knowledge into wisdom. Now in permanence, the Nietzsche, the fact that things are always in flux and changing, it can also feel like a nice philosophy. You know, it's this time of year, you can feel the seasons changing, and there's a way of kind of being in harmony with it. Now, my grandfather, I was privileged enough to spend some time with him in the last month or so of his life. And he was a Christian man and talked about this one phrase from the Bible, that this too shall pass, and how this phrase was by some considered the most profound of the Bible. And I could tell that he was taking some solace in this, that, you know, in the fact of being in hospice and that this too shall pass and the naturalness of that. And then one day he wanted to shave. You know, he hadn't shaved for a few weeks. And we cleared out the hallway, got him to where the bathroom was, and he saw his reflection, his image in the mirror, after not seeing it for probably a month or so. And his first phrase, his first words were, "Is that me? Is that me? You know, have I changed that much? Have I deteriorated that much? Have I passed that much?" So in that instant, this concept of this too shall pass, this statement of wisdom, transformed into this very personal knowledge. So the personal suffering was a gateway into true wisdom, into true wisdom. And then in anatta, the sense of self. And often we can work with that. Sometimes there's a sense of curiosity, sometimes confusion about what that means. And then we actually experience it. And this is an ordinary thing that we often kind of gloss over. You know, when you have a role in your life, you know, for those of you who are retired, who have have children, have left the house, think about how that felt when that role ended. That sense of identity no longer was present. It was no longer needed. When you lose a relationship, when someone passes away, and that when a parent dies, when a child dies, there's a change of relationship, you know, a change of role that can often be very shaking. And this is this investment we often take into that identity. These are much more bigger expressions of this. But it's this very sense of taking myself, the sense of who I am as being a solid creature, a solid thing here. There's a relativeness of it, of course. But if you look closer and closer, we see that it's just arising based on conditions. Sometimes those conditions are being a parent. Sometimes there are conditions of having a certain work or a certain relationship. And when those conditions change, that thing we thought as being so solid is no, it's so solid. So moving from this idea of non-self into seeing it manifesting. So you can see how compassion really helps to make wisdom something that's actually wise, not something that's intellectual or abstract. Now, if you look at the other side of the picture, how compassion is actually tempered and informed by wisdom, actually needs wisdom as a stabilizing force, as a way to help ground us in the midst of the immense suffering of life. And when we experience suffering, when we feel it, pain, emotional pain, physical pain, it often is a little overwhelming, sometimes very overwhelming. And what's happening is, you know, neurology and science is showing us that our brains become hijacked by the stress response. You know, our neural systems, our sympathetic nervous system, our hormones shift over to survival mode. We actually lose capacity to reason, to think, to access our prefrontal cortex. And we really lose that capacity because the priority shifts to survival. This is actually helpful when there's something that's an acute danger. The trouble is when that danger is amorphous, when it's made up, when it's in your mind, when it's something that you're anticipating will happen. That's one of the reasons mindfulness is so helpful, that it helps us regain that connection to our ability to reason, to have our executive function. This is part of the reason that wisdom and compassion have to work together. We have to be able to connect with this moment's experience. So when the quivering of the heart, when it's not balanced with wisdom, it can sometimes feel very shaking. One of the key aspects when that happens is our relationship to thought, to concept, to self-belief. Because when we're really upset about something, it's because it really means something to us. It means something about us. It means something about something that we really care about. Another person, the environment. You know, I'm sure there's many things we can talk about that we are very deeply concerned about. Right? From a wisdom standpoint, that's all based on an investment in thought, in concept. From the deepest level of wisdom, all thoughts are essentially equal. All thoughts are essentially equally true. Or you could also say equally untrue. And so even those deep thoughts of, you know, this is absolutely the right side of the argument, this is the right side of the political spectrum, that in itself, that investment in thought creates the seeds for suffering. It's not to say that we shouldn't have those opinions and act from them, but just to know that that's what we're doing, is we're investing in thought and tying ourselves to some level of suffering. So wisdom starts to reveal the nature of thought. I mean, think about when you meditate, how many of your thoughts are really wise? How many of them make even sense? You know, you're sitting and you're trying to watch your breath, and then you think about something that happened when you were in, you know, kindergarten, or, you know, 2 years ago, or something that might happen in the future. It's like it's just this random display. And we start to see that as meditators, not as a concept, but actually seeing it. It starts to sober us up a little bit to the nature of thought itself, to hold it a little lighter. So with wisdom in interfacing with compassion, when we're really engaged in something that's worrisome, that sense of finding the contact with the body is so helpful, so essential. You know, what actually... where is the contact of the body on the ground? Can you actually feel the floor? Can you actually feel the cushion? And what does that sensation actually feel like? That sense of connecting your attention starts to shift you out of that sympathetic nervous system, the fight and flight, to make actual contact. This last week, just on Wednesday, my daughter's in high school, first freshman in high school. You know, as a parent, there's always new things to worry about at each stage, right? So she got this Instagram of this basically a threat for a shooting. You know, that the whole, you know, a lot of the school got, and so she got this, and she was very worried about it, and as I was very worried about it, you know, and so when that happens, you're overwhelmed. You don't know what to do. So what to do is like you connect with the body sensation. Feel that pit of despair, of terror in your belly. Feel the body get tight and see if you can bring some breath to that. You know, the sense of feeling the pain but not being shaken by it. And then asking, okay, what is needed in this moment? I asked her, how does she feel about that? And kind of starting to problem solve, how legitimate are the authorities taking care of this, and is there really a danger? And it turned out to be not dangerous, that someone had just copied something else and put the school's name, and they found the individual, so there was no trouble. But in the midst of that, you know, it's a very rare thing, you know, and feeling the fear and the sadness of a daughter who has to go to school worrying about that, the fear of being a parent, to have that in the back of my mind. I mean, this is the life that we live in. You know, so how not to be shaken by it is to find that root in the ground, root in the body. So connecting with the body. Another way to work with it is to see the commonality of suffering. That when you're really upset, when you're really overwashed by compassion, by the heart being broken open, it often feels very personal, like you're the only one who's ever felt this. No one else has felt it to this depth. Often when we do practice interview groups during these retreats, someone shares something, often very tender, and you see, you look around, everyone else is nodding. Everyone else is saying, yeah, I have experienced that. And that sense of commonality starts to take it from being this personal pain to this universal quality. This universal quality. In that time at the Buddha, there's a famous sutta where this woman had lost her child, her only child. And she was so awashed with grief that her mind could not accept that. So she was carrying her dead child around, trying to find someone to bring her child back to life. And so finally people said, you know, go talk to the Buddha. You know, the Buddha looked at the situation and didn't tell the woman that he could revive the child, but said, I think I can find medicine that will help you, help your mind. But all I need is a mustard seed from a house that has never experienced loss, has never experienced grief. So this woman goes door to door asking for mustard seeds, and people say, of course, we have plenty, but it has to be from someone who's not, a house that has not lost anyone. And house after house, she saw that every house had been touched by loss, by grief. And through this direct seeing, it started to shift her personal pain to this much more universalness of it, this shared experience that we all will grieve, we all will lose what we care about, what we hold dear, sometimes so dear as a mother and their child. Commonality, also there's a sense of expanding the field, holding this pain in a much broader thing, a broader sense of knowing, of awareness. Because when we're hurting, we often tighten up. Like physically, sometimes we close down. You can see that when someone's hurting. And to be able to, okay, open that up and have a sense of it moving through the body. You know, an analogy in the suttas is if you took this bowl here and filled it with water and I put a cup of salt in there, it would be so salty. Right? But I take this whole room and fill it with water, that same cup of salt would be so diluted. Be easily held by the space in the room. So too, when we have intense pain arising, if you can start to hold it in a broader sense, I mean, literally imagining like the whole room is holding this, or a sense of sharing it with a friend, with a loved one, with a support group, sharing it with a teacher, sharing it with nature, can start to dilute that pain. As you're sitting, feeling the body as a whole, feeling the parts of the body which are well, which are comfortable, as equally as you feel the parts which aren't. This balances and relaxes the mindfulness, so it has this capacity to start to hold the difficult. These are all ways that wisdom starts to come in to help balance compassion. So in this way that we can see that wisdom and compassion really are so interdependent, so you cannot separate them out. And when we get caught in one, our practice feels a little off. We get a little dry. We get a little arrogant in our dharma. You know, we say, oh, if only you would meditate, you would feel much better. Right? Have you ever said that or heard that from someone? Right? Or when life is really sweeping you off the feet. You know, how can we find that place of balance? And sometimes the thing is to learn how to take a respite, to take a break from the overwhelm, to know how, be very honest with how your capacity to hold this pain is, and how to learn to find a place where that can meet that. So this weekend, you know, we'll be exploring this interplay between wisdom and compassion, and how it really shows up as a live practice. All right, thank you for your attention. And now we have a chance for some questions or dialogue, and we'll just take turns responding. It is, yeah, absolutely. So the question is around, you know, wisdom and compassion. And our tradition tends to be a little on the passive side. There's a sense of you just meet this moment's experience and you don't do anything with it. And this is the instructions of how to really learn to see clearly through our reactivity. And then the next part is, then what do you do with it? And so it's tricky because so much of our initial, maybe not even initial, but it's learning how not to do anything with the moment's experience, because that allows us to actually see it more and more clearly. And yet, once we do that, then there's something else that starts to move us to act that's not based in our normal reactivity, our normal sense of duality, our sense of self and other. And it's often coming from a very different place. And so when we're having the luxury to just sit quietly, it's much more that sense of receiving, noticing this moment's experience. But when you open your eyes and leave the hall and you meet another human being, when you meet yourself, you know, the first thing is to resonate, to really feel what's there, and then say, okay, what's needed? What action is going to be helpful in this? And sometimes it's just listening more, sometimes it's a much more forceful, powerful action. But it's the key is to start, as we were talking before, is like that space between stimulus and response. There's that pause. Mindfulness brings that pause in. So instead of going to our normal reactivity mode, which causes more and more suffering, we actually have a way of interjecting wisdom and compassion. And it's also something that's going to be very spontaneous and based on that moment. You know, one action may be very wise. The exact same action, a different scenario, may not be so. So it's kind of an alive koan that I think we all have to work with. You want to add anything, or should you take the next question?
Maybe we'll see if there's another question. There's always a lot around that, like around action. But let's see if anything else is up for you. Do either of these elements kind of resonate more than the other? Can you feel kind of a subtle preference for one or the other? Wisdom and wisdom love, wisdom compassion. Can you say that a little louder, the last part? You said wisdom helping you with your compassion. The wisdom driving your actions because it can discern when there is something that you can do, and then that propels you into action. Okay. So you're connecting with compassion as a feeling rather than as a response or an intention. Yeah. And within your community, it's easier to tell, oh, this is what's needed. Let me do this. Yeah. Where you can have an impact. No, but that's a good insight. So often I feel, again, for myself as well, what impedes action is some combination of helplessness that isn't accurate, some feeling of powerlessness, like it's not going to make a difference, and overwhelm, not knowing what to do, right? So, and there may be a very clear, sort of innocent first response of, oh, let me help. But then following that through, not knowing what it is that would be helpful. Would this really help? I don't know what could help. Maybe it's not going to make a difference anyway. What do I do? It's like the mind hijacks what actually began as an initial impulse to help alleviate suffering. And it got in a twist, in a torment. So yeah, they do inform each other. And I think I don't know, for some reason I'm on heartbreak tonight, but I think it's Andrew Harvey who says, when we're trying to discern what to do, there's so many things to care about in the world, so many places that are so deserving of our time and energy and attention. And his response was to first follow your heartbreak. Like, what's the deepest, you know, pick one in terms of the world situation and just do one thing. You know, I know one of our teachers, Gil Fronsdale, said the same thing. Just if there's an impulse to help, just do one thing. Make one response, write one letter, make one call. And often that will help kind of alleviate some of the overwhelm and question some of the powerlessness. So doing one thing, often in the direction of maybe what stirs the heart most profoundly. So Gil's example was his response to 9/11, what he was sitting with. Well, what should I do? And he started a chaplaincy program in Northern California. Just so many conversations with people about death and dying around 9/11. And so what can I do? And just following one thing and then the next, without the idea that we have to take it all on, but in a spirit of, you know, just taking the next step based on what's around me, what I'm discerning might be helpful. So the question of wisdom, kind of married with compassion, always feels to me like, what does this need now? The situation of suffering. What does this need now? You know, so it's not just empathy, that's a start, but it's also, it moves out. Right? It moves out. Okay. How are you doing? Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is just to recognize that it's arising. Because, you know, so often we say, okay, of course I'm ill, I'm feeling angry toward this experience, this other person, and it's completely justified. Because if they stop doing what they were doing, I wouldn't be angry anymore. It's all their fault. So first thing is to kind of have that sense of realizing, I have to take responsibility for my own experience. And you know, certainly, you know, someone else's actions influence it. It may be very justified. But learning to come back into our own kind of field of power, which is our own experience, then it becomes workable. And I can feel, okay, I have this impulse to lash out. Right? I have anger, ill will. And then how to work with it. Like Carrie, you're just saying that sense of first connecting with it, to connect with that quality of feeling it in the body, that sense of rage, that sense of ill will. Letting the outside fade for a little bit, you know, suspending that for a moment. That quivering of the heart in response to that suffering, the suffering of the ill will, then asking what is needed here? You know, do I need to say something in a clear boundary setting way? Do I need to bring metta in as a way to work with that? Do I need to find some other way to make a difference? You know, there's really an immense creativity. And then you learn to see what helps and what may not help. And we learn that through trial and error and the feedback we get from life.
Yeah. Could everybody hear? Okay. Yeah. Great. Yeah, and it can often feel like that, I think, for us on the spiritual path. Like we're having a human experience some of the time and a spiritual experience some of the time. And it can feel, you know, we can frame it that way for ourselves. It's like, how do these two come together? You know, flashes of what seems like maybe insight into more than just this human experience, but also deeply human experiences as well. So compassion as a deeply, you know, in its essence, a deeply human experience. But it's an interesting question of how we can feel the two coming together, becoming more integrated.
Yeah. Yeah, just a couple of thoughts around that is the insights when they arise, just them arising is great, but we have to practice them. Christina Feldman, who was here a couple of weeks ago in Seattle, talked about insights, we have to practice them. That practicing is where compassion arises. That sense of how do you actually show up in your, really in the specifics of your life, the specific details of how you work, of how you relate, of how you, of you hold yourself. So the insights arise. It's often an insight, if you boil it down, it's often a movement from suffering to the end of suffering. Practice it. And that practicing takes the form of compassionate action. And that can be a way, a beautiful way to start to integrate those two. And it works the other way too, I believe. That when compassion, when we feel that sense of tenderness, it becomes this motivation to understand deeply. And then that understanding, then that becomes an insight. And then we go back into the compassionate action. All right, looks like that might be enough for tonight.